Okay, this hour we've got Dick Morris with us. We're going to take calls and talk about futurism. Next hour, I'll start open lines on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Dick Morris with us. Final hour to go. Dick, how did you get involved and interested in futurism?
Well, I've always, you know, I read everything.
yes, you do.
And I read a wonderful book by a guy who I think you've had as a guest on your show, Ray Carswell.
Yes, he's been a couple
who, won the 2005 Science Award in the United States.
He's working for Google now, isn't he?
He is. Thank God he is.
Yeah.
His book was called The Singularity Is Near. And it just really expanded my consciousness. And over the intervening years, I've watched everything he predicted come true. And none of this is my original work, but I don't feel that people understand what the future is going to be like. And we're on the cusp of some unbelievable changes over the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and certainly over the next 20 or 25. And I just thought it'd be interesting when you invited me on your show to discuss some of that stuff. The first thing, one of the immediate things, is that we're going to have a way of having a Google search engine and a GPS implanted in our brains. And
oh boy.
The idea of Google itself is, of course, revolutionary because it means suddenly all of human knowledge is at our fingertips. You know, something in revolutionary France, Diderot wrote the first encyclopedia, all human knowledge. And now it's just available to everybody with a click of a mouse. But in a few years, it's going to be inside our heads. And if I ask you to recite the first act of Julius Caesar, you're going to do it. You don't know that you can,
wow.
But you will.
And languages and everything else.
Exactly. And also GPSs. You go into a completely strange environment, you'll know where you are. You'll know your way around, even as if you've been there your whole life, even if you've never been there. But that's just really the beginning. Human beings will live longer and longer and longer because the key there is our ability to reduce computers to the size of a single cell. We're very close to that. Once we're able to do that, we'll be able to program cells in your body and give you an injection and say, hey, George's arteries look a little clogged. Would you guys go clean them out? And like Roto-Rooter, they'll clean out your arteries for you.
Give me another 10 years.
Cancer forming in his bowel. I'd like you to get rid of that. And they'll go down there and do that. And the idea is that your body will be able to regrow and regenerate by proper maintenance from within. There's nothing inherent about aging, the human being. Aging is a series of mistakes that can be corrected. Mm-hmm. But nanotechnology, reducing computers to the size of cells, will be able to do that.
Will it be for the rich?
But wait a minute. Then we inevitably it will. That's a big problem. Then you go the next step, which is really the big step, which is called the singularity, which is that robots and humans become one. The great philosopher Kierkegaard once said the fundamental dilemma that man has is he has an immortal soul trapped inside of a dying animal. And this will end that conundrum. And you will be able to scan your consciousness into a robot. And you will then live forever in the body of the robot. And you'll live forever. And it'll be you, entirely you, but when you look down, you'll see a robot. Just an incredible kind of a change, an unbelievable evolution. And I think that all of these changes, all of these new occurrences and new phenomena will so fundamentally change the world that when we sit here and we make projections of what the world's going to look like in 2050, we're just crazy. We don't understand a tenth of what's really going to happen. Now, you say for the rich people, the other thing that will happen is the ability to choose your children, not just from your own sperm and her eggs, but from a list of people. You'll have a list of children, embryos. You could have any implanted that you want. You want an Albert Einstein. You want
a football player,
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
whatever.
You want Marilyn Monroe. You got them. And that raises an issue of the pro-life, pro-choice debate and puts it in an entirely different context of man completely playing God. And then you go back to Hitler's idea of the master race. Well, hell, there will be a master race, those who could afford to do this, who will give birth to children who are far brighter, far more beautiful, and far stronger, and far more disease-resistant than those who can't afford to do that. And government will try to regulate it, and there'll be lines of yachts in the Mediterranean in international waters administering these treatments to mothers who want to become pregnant. And this future technology is going to become so advanced that it's going to be very hard for human beings to catch up and understand it. It is not going to be robots against humans. It'll be robots and humans combining and creating a capacity for intelligence that is geometrically beyond what we now have. And we're on the cusp of these changes, and nobody's thinking about it, nobody's writing about it, nobody's talking about the ethics about it. Instead, we're debating the Social Security Trust Fund. And believe me, the changes will be enormous. Birth and death will become increasingly rare phenomena as people are able to live forever.
It's happening too fast, too, Dick, isn't it?
Well, you don't get a choice. And one of the points that Carswell makes is that as computers, as robots, or computers, if you will, invent other computers, it becomes an exponential curve where it goes up in multiples, and human intelligence and the new intelligence just outraces everything. So that we really cannot anticipate what that's going to be. There will be huge problems, but there will also be huge human intelligence to deal with them, an unbelievable capacity of analysis and stuff, intraplanetary travel, outer space, all of that stuff becomes fully realistic within the context of the kind of exponential increases in intelligence that we're talking about when machines build machines.
And I've got to tell you, Dick, that this effort that is happening cannot be stopped either. We can't stop it even if we wanted to,
yeah,
can we?
That's right. We can try to regulate it. We can make ethical choices surrounding it. But fundamentally, it's going to happen to us, whether we like it or not. And so when I hear people going passionate about climate change and saying, oh my God, in 100 years, the sea levels will be, 5 feet higher than they are now, and 20% of the world will be flooded. Come on, by 2100, it will be such a different world with so many different things that it'll be a footnote, and we'll long since have dealt with all of those issues. Fundamentally, when you get down to it, in all of human history, the constant has been the human being. Never changed. Human nature always the same. Now that will change.
We're going to get to calls in a second. You've jammed every phone line here, Dick. They've all called you from everywhere. But I want to ask you about ISIS. There's something wrong. There's something I can't put my finger on. We've got the power to shut banks down, to seize assets. I don't get how ISIS can get their oil, get it pumped, put it in tankers, sell it, and continue on. There's something I don't get here. What's going on?
Fundamental decision that Barack Obama has not taken, that Hillary has not taken, and Donald Trump will take. Bomb the damn oil fields. Three-quarters of ISIS's money comes from the oil that it...
Or the tankers.
You can bomb tankers, you can bomb trucks and all that, but mainly bomb the oil fields so they can't generate the stuff. And the reason we're not doing it, you're sitting down, we're worried about the environmental damage it will cause.
Oh, wow.
Contributions to climate change. There's a reason. The problem with the Obama and Hillary approaches, there's always a reason not to do something. And ultimately, it's paralytic.
Would Bill have jumped in and done something big?
No.
He would
not about this, because he would be immobilized by the left. But listen, when we invaded Kuwait, Saddam Hussein set Kuwait's oil wells on fire, all
Yes,
of
he
them.
did.
And it wasn't just with a bomb. He was able to really do it from the inside because he controlled the ground. And there was a huge, gigantic fire. And for a week or 2 weeks, much of the Arabian Peninsula was dark, you know, as if it had a cloud cover.
Yeah.
But no sustained environmental damage. And in a couple of weeks, it blew away.
It went away.
And Kuwait is 3 million barrels a day. ISIS has 125,000. It's not going to be permanent. And by the way, this gets to a longer theme, which is one of the elements of the Sanders approach and of the Hillary approach is to ban or limit fracking, you know, the artificial way of getting oil out by pumping water down, shattering the slate. No impact on the water table. It's ridiculous. You frack 10,000 feet down. The water table is 10 feet down. If water could go through 10,000 feet of rock, you wouldn't need to frack. Fracking is the anti-terror policy of our time. Because of fracking, oil is now down below $40. Oil, which we've grown up thinking is the most prized, black gold, the treasure, oil is going to be like air. It's going to be the least expensive, cheapest thing to do. You're going to be drowning in oil. And both because of greater efficiency in its use, switching to natural gas, better science, but mainly because of fracking and deep sea offshore drilling. And and that is the key to terrorism, because without oil, those economies are about as viable as sub-Sahara Africa. They'll be with tin cups on the corner. And you can only do this kind of garbage of going around slitting throats if you don't have to worry about how to make a living.
Exactly.
And if you cut off the oil supplies, the oil revenues, those folks are going to be broke. And that's the long-term answer.
Well, exactly. And get to these banks that are helping them.
Yes, yes. Yes, interdict the money supply. Yeah. You certainly have to do that.
Let's go to the phones. Bill is truck driving in Indiana, wildcard line. Bill, you'll be the first. Go ahead.
Hey, Bill.
Yeah. Hey, George. Hey, Dick. Hey, I have a question about the futurism and this conflict between technology and political systems. I'm very cynical. You could almost say I got a lot of anxiety about this because I don't have much faith in our political system. It's sort of invariably or inevitably self-corrupting. And I worry that, you know, I see sort of like an Elysium. I don't know if you've seen the movie Elysium with Matt Damon, where the masses of people don't benefit from this
right.
increase in technology. But I also see a small chance it could end up like Star Trek, a Star Trek type future, an almost utopian type future where the masses of people do benefit. But I think a lot of that relies on our ability to change politically. Do you see any hope for a better future? Or do
yeah,
you think
I do. Donald J. Trump. because you got to have somebody who is powerful enough, wealthy enough, independent enough, and has a strong enough personality to impose his will on this international community, hold it back, rein it in, and begin to assert the interests of the average person. And Trump is able to do that. Hillary isn't. She's going to be, you know, constantly paralysis by analysis. We have five options and so on. But Trump will make it happen. Trump is a builder. He gets it done. And I know that sometimes that seems dangerous. He seems authoritarian. He seems powerful. But we need some of that. I mean, for God's sakes, we've had this weak, vacillating, indecisive, ineffective status quo management in the White House. And we need somebody like Trump to do that. And I'm not trying to turn what you said into a political ad, but it is tens of millions of people just like you who are alienated, who don't vote, who never voted, who aren't going to vote. But then they look and there is finally a guy that can penetrate all of this and really bring about change. And he's personally situated in a way where he can do that. All he cares about is his historical legacy.
What kind of people do you think Trump will surround himself with?
I think he'll surround himself with very good, very independent, very strong businessmen. I think it's going to be a cabinet filled with people like a Carl Icahn, people that are doers to get the thing done. It's not going to be like Jimmy Carter, who ran as an outsider.
Right.
And then the first thing he did was appoint a cabinet that could have served Gerald Ford just as easily. Instead, I think it's going to be a very independent, very separate group of people led by a very strong leader. I see Trump as a fantastic president. I see him as a new Reagan.
You really do?
Yep.
I wonder how he'll get along with people like Putin and China.
Oh, Putin. Why do you think Putin's dumping all the stuff on Hillary? He and Putin are going to make a deal. They're going to sit down and they're going to cut a deal.
Over a beer, probably.
With everybody. And the deal will be, you can do this and we'll do that, and you do this and we'll do that. And together, let's end this ISIS thing. Let's get rid of this Muslim extremist stuff. And it will really be a deal. And Trump, the problem is that you can't negotiate with Obama because there's nobody to talk to. Netanyahu is a client of mine. And he always...
I like him.
I love him. And he's always complaining, how do you do business with Obama? I mean, you know, one minute you cut a deal and the next minute he's gone. He's distracted, not paying attention. If he pays attention, he's always having second thoughts and third thoughts and tenth thoughts.
Does he doubt himself a lot?
Obama?
Yeah.
Never doubts himself, ever, ever, ever. That's one of his weaknesses. But he does change his mind all the time and flip-flop and be indecisive.
Even after you shake hands on it?
Yeah. Yeah, even after you do, assuming he's not germophobic and he will shake your hand.
Walt in Pennsylvania. Hey, Walt, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Hey, Walt.
Hi, George. Once again, I'm honored to speak with you, and I want to commend your guest. I've enjoyed his commentary on Fox for years.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to be disowned by the liberal democratic faction of my family, but I have a cousin who formerly worked for the DNC in Washington back in the 80s and 90s. In fact, she met her husband while they both worked for the Mondale Ferraro ticket. And she told us back more than 20 years ago that it was more or less common knowledge that Hillary is a chronic acute diabetic. I don't know if she actually, you know, my cousin doesn't know if she actually has to shoot insulin, but she said it was commonly known that she commonly gets dizzy spells and more or less passes out at the drop of a hat.
Not when I knew her.
Well, I guess she's had a couple episodes, you know, that...
There may be something going on there medically, I don't know. But when I knew her, that was not a problem. And come on, the one thing you got to give her is she works like a damn animal. And you know, and if you can keep up that kind of pace at that
stop.
Age,
yeah.
You got to be pretty healthy.
I'm amazed that Bernie kept the pace up.
Yeah.
For him.
74 years old, imagine.
Yeah. He must be glad this is over.
No, no. He wake up in the morning and say, "What do I do today?
What did I do?" Right?
Yeah. I mean, you can't get off that adrenaline high in a day.
I was very impressed with Trump's children.
Yeah,
all of them.
I love that line. You can't fake good kids.
Nope.
And you'll be very unimpressed with Chelsea on Thursday night.
I've got a friend who is running Hillary's campaign in Missouri. Do you know Joyce Abusi, by any chance?
No.
Okay, she's doing that. Of course, having a friend doesn't mean I'm endorsing anybody. I don't. I never do that, Dick. I just like to be able to call it the way I see it. What about the libertarian? Have you looked at Gary Johnson at all?
No, and I refuse to.
How come?
I don't give a damn if he's Superman. A vote for Gary Johnson is a vote for Hillary.
Ah, we're going to come back and wrap things up with final calls. Dick Morris on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Dick Morris, his book Armageddon. Dick, where do you get your energy? I mean, you're all over the place.
Well, I have it. I'm very blessed with that. My dad died 6 years ago at the age of 100.
Oh.
And he taught law school until he was 96.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. That is why he lived so long. He didn't stop.
Yeah.
He didn't retire.
That's right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You.
I love this show, George. It was such an opportunity to explain stuff and go into detail on stuff. You know, you get so. I was on CNBC today, and you know, before the show, they talk about all the things they're going to cover, and then right before camera time says, "So we have 5.5 minutes."
Well, you're invited, Dick, anytime you want. Okay.
Well, I love the show. I really would like to be back.
Oh, absolutely. And you were on my affiliate in Philadelphia for a couple of years, WPHT.
For 2 years, I was in, did talk radio in Philly, and then CBS sold the station. But I had an absolute ball. I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
I loved interacting with people when they called, and I learned so much from them.
What has been for you the most satisfying part of your career? Everything you've done, what's that one thing that stands out for you?
Oddly enough, it took place in Mexico. You mentioned when you introed me that I work on foreign campaigns a lot. And, you know, this corrupt PRI, the Permanent Revolutionary Party, had run Mexico since 1917. And it was totally mired in corruption and just screwing the people all over the country. And in 1999, I worked for Vicente Fox, who was elected president of Mexico. And it was the first non-pre-election. And really the beginning of freedom in Mexico. And then I handled the next president, Felipe Calderon's election. And being part of, in a sense, liberating Mexico was a very important part of my life.
Are you going to be the go-between between Mexico and Trump when he was
when
he wants to build that wall?
No, I'll buy tickets and sit on the sidelines. You know, Trump doesn't say this, but he needs to. When NAFTA passed, Mexico had a trade deficit with the United States. We sold them $2 billion more than they bought from us. Now they sell us $75 billion more than we buy from them.
Unbelievable.
And the flip side of that is when Clinton let China into the World Trade Organization in 94, China ran a $30 billion trade surplus with the United States. Now it's $600
billion. $600 billion. And they own everything in this country.
Yes, yes. But China is doomed, as is Russia. Russia, because it's energy dependent, it's essentially Saudi Arabia. It's got an economy that's entirely focused on energy. And that's a fool's errand. That's the 20th century fiction, that oil is scarce and that those who have it are destined to great wealth. The opposite is true. Those who are based on an energy economy are going to be completely out of business, just like those who were invested in an agrarian economy would, because farming would produce all the food in the world for very little work, very little population. And China, because they have this, because you have only about 20% of the country that's working in the global economy and stuff that's really important. And most of those companies are foreign owned, most or at least heavily, partially owned by foreigners. The China's kind of the assembly point. But of the other 80%, half are subsistence farmers and half work for the state sector. And the state sector is this collection of industries that produce nothing that anyone wants to buy, build cities nobody ever lives in, build bridges nobody ever crosses. And they're simply public works make work. And the reason the government does it is to give the people who work there the illusion that they're employed so they don't go and overthrow the government.
Isn't a doomed nation, though, kind of a nation we need to be careful of? Because they'll do just about anything?
No. No, I think that, I don't think our major threats are going to come from Russia and China or from terrorism, really. I think that, I think that Trump on immigration will be very effective. And I think that once you bring the price of oil permanently down, those economies can't function. They can't survive. Look, the second leading export of Iran after oil is like rugs or pistachio nuts. I mean,
I love pistachio nuts. Let's go to our international line. Elizabeth's with us in Ontario, Canada. Hello, Elizabeth. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, George. Hi, Mr. Morris.
Hi.
I had a question about the 2012 election. It was just a little odd that everyone seemed to think that Romney was a shoo-in there, and then he sort of disappeared, and Obama seemed very confident right from the beginning he was going to do it. Was there anything
Hurricane Sandy
that you could tell
happened.
Us about that?
In the 1 week before the election, about 5 days before the election, this horrific hurricane swept through the northeastern United States, and it knocked out everything. And you couldn't poll in the last 5 days of the election because there were no phone lines. And therefore, everybody was kind of flying blind during that period. And during that period, Christie, the governor of New Jersey, invited Obama to tour the state with him and went around the state hand in hand with Obama. And Christie had had a reputation of being an extreme right-wing, aggressive, hard-nosed politician, and Obama as a leftist, strong Democrat. And the combination of the two of them made them both seem nonpartisan, above politics, and interested in the people. And that little bit of theater turned around all of the tracking polls in all the campaigns and gave Obama the victory. And the reason many people, including me, missed it is that there wasn't polling during that last 5 days.
When you look at everything that's happening with this campaign right now, Dick, how close will it come where pundits are really able to make some predictions?
Well, they'll make predictions constantly, but there are two big obstacles to their predicting this election accurately. One obstacle manifested in two ways. There are millions and millions of people who are going to vote for Donald Trump and don't know it yet. They're not going to say it yet. They're not even much going to think it yet. When do you buy Christmas presents for your wife, George?
Well, I don't have a wife, but
okay. Well, your girlfriend, your family—that would most.
Now you're getting personal, Morris.
Okay, but most men would say.
I would say very late.
Yeah,
very
late. December 24th, and my wife buys my presents like in August and September and October. So she's like the informed voter, and I'm like the uninformed voter. I only pay attention the day before Christmas, and then I buy something. But you could deluge me with ads for Christmas shopping for months, and I wouldn't pay any attention to it. The flip side of that, maybe gender reversal, is football.
Mm-hmm.
There are guys that pay attention from the training camps on, and by the time the Super Bowl happens, they've been so immersed in football for the whole year. And then there are a bunch of people who don't pay any attention to it, many women, and until they have to cater the Super Bowl party. And they suddenly realize there is a Super Bowl. They learn who's going to be in it. They learn a little bit of the gossip and the tidbits about it. And they kind of root and enjoy it and participate in it. They're like the uninformed voter. So if you ask these folks now, are you likely to vote in the election? They'll say, hell no, I never vote. I never vote. I don't bother with that. But then a day or two before the election, they're going to say, hey, you know, this guy Trump, he's really talking to me in a way politicians don't. I might end up voting for him, and then they do. And throughout the early going, they're going to be registering as undecided or non-voters, or they refuse to vote.
Yeah.
And then they show up, and that's how we won all of these primaries, by bringing these people out of the woodwork. And I think that can happen now.
And assuming nothing happens legally to Hillary, I think like you are right now, it's going to be very, very close.
Not necessarily close. It's going to be unpredictable.
Isn't unpredictable close?
No. Unpredictable could be a landslide. we can't predict what's going to happen with her emails, with the Russians.
Right.
I think there's a real chance they could release those. And a few an October surprise right before the election. And the other thing that's unpredictable is ISIS. You have a Paris or an Orlando or a Brussels a week before the election, and boy, that is going to influence things. Or you have a police shooting like Dallas, an ambush, that's going to change things. And those events could radically alter the election.
True. I think they helped Donald.
Smart. They do.
Yeah.
And Trump's been pretty smart in laying the predicate so that if they do happen, God forbid, they do help him.
Good point. Let's go next to Stephen in Troy, Illinois. First-time caller. Stephen, you're on with Dick Morris.
Hi, Stephen.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
First-time caller, long-time listener. And let me just say this. Dick Morris is one of my heroes.
Love
your lunch alerts and
thank you.
And I hope that you have the same fortune as your father to live a very long life.
Bless you. You know what he means about my lunch alerts is I have this email list on dickmorris.com, and it's 400,000 people. And every day I do a lunch alert, a video about politics for that day. It's going to be a little late tomorrow because
we're keeping you up late.
And but every day I send it out. And on Saturdays, it's a history video. This Saturday will be about George Washington's unbelievable military skill. And so if you want to subscribe to that, and it is kind of cool and it's free, just go to dickmorris.com and enter your address, and I'll send them to you every morning. But you're so nice to call in.
And back to you, Stephen. Did you have a question for Dick?
Yes. With your vast knowledge of the world and, you know, it just drilling down into so many details, do you have any interest or plans in the future of linking up with filmmakers to make documentaries to kind of, you know, the power of cinema is huge, as you know, and I think that would be a great collaboration for you to get together with.
Good idea. I did some of that. In fact, you know, the Citizens United decision, the Democrats go crazy about. I did the video for Citizens United that was the basis of that case. It was an anti-Hillary video, and I've done a few of those. I did one called Fahrenheit 9/11, which was a counter to. Whatever the guy's name is, the liberal who from Michigan who did the Fahrenheit 9/11. So I might do more of that. It's an art form that I really like and might have some fun doing that.
Dick, we're in an era now, too, where our presidential candidates are not having military experience. Hillary obviously does not. Donald Trump has had deferments. Does that affect anything?
Yeah, it does. I think that Bill was very hesitant about the use of military force because he had not had military experience, and because back then somebody who dodged the draft was really suspect in the military and in those kinds of circles.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that affected him a good deal. I think less so now. One of the problems I have with Hillary is, if I had to bet, I would say that there is an 80% chance that she'll get us into a big war. And Trump, I'd give you only about a 20% chance. Hillary is cantankerous. She's aggressive. She's constantly fighting. And she was part of Iraq. She got us into Libya. She tried to get us into Syria. And the subconscious with Hillary is that as a woman, she has to prove her strength. She has to prove her mettle. Be more like Margaret Thatcher,
yeah.
Gold in my
yeah.
ear. And the problem is that often will lead to an involvement in one of these endless wars that go
on. No, you're right. Where I see Donald as somebody who would try to settle an agreement first.
He'll cut a deal.
Cut a deal.
You want a story about Donald Trump? It's such a great story. There's a woman, I guess I shouldn't use her name, who lived in Virginia, who married an immensely, immensely wealthy man. And they built this glorious home together, beautiful, one of the most beautiful homes in the country. And after the guy died, after they were divorced and he died, he left her an alimony that declined as interest rates dropped. So she went broke, extravagant lifestyle, but she couldn't afford it.
Ugh.
And the bank foreclosed on her home. And she called Trump and she said, "Can you help me with this? And can you buy it from me for $20 million?" And Trump said, "I'm not going to pay $20 million for that." Then what Trump did was he contacted the bank, and they also said, you know, $20 million. So then what Trump did was he said, "Okay." He called the woman back and said, "I'll buy the land around your house." And by that, he meant a border of land literally coming up to her front door.
Yeah.
And she sold it to him so that if you stepped in or out of the house, you were trespassing on Trump's property.
Smart move.
The house was totally worthless. And then Trump got it for $1 million or $2 million. He's opening a resort there.
Brilliant move.
That's Donald Trump. He'll figure out a way to do it.
He'll probably go to the Chinese and say, "You want this little island you've made? Go ahead and take it."
No, I don't think he'll do that. I think that, you mean Taiwan?
No, not Taiwan. You know those phony
the
islands?
South China Sea. Yeah,
yeah. The phony islands they're building.
Yeah, I don't.
I mean, who wants those? They're making them.
Of course. And we almost went to war over Quemoy and Matsu. They're two uninhabited islands.
Taiwan, right. Taiwan's a war.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's not going to happen. And ultimately, China can't afford that.
What about North Korea?
Well, there's a solution to that. And again, Obama and Hillary are obstructing it. The solution to North Korea, and by the way, to Iran, is missile interceptors. You know, Reagan's Star Wars couldn't work, but Israel's Iron Dome sure did. When it's a limited number of missiles, it works. But the key to it, that make it completely effective, is base it in outer space. When you have a space-based missile interceptor, you can look down and see when the enemy missile is launched. And while it's leaving the launch pad, traveling at 80 or 90 miles an hour, just beginning its trajectory,
just starting,
you can take it out. And the radioactive debris falls on the attacking country, not on the recipient country. And you can completely eliminate their capacity to terrorize us with those ballistic missiles. Why aren't we doing that? Why do we not have space-based interceptors? We have land-based, we have sea-based, but that you can't do it until they're high up in the trajectory, and you can miss, and the debris falls in your own country. Why don't we have space-based? Because Hillary helped negotiate a ban on littering in outer space.
And it's so littered now, it's unbelievable. I'm amazed we haven't been hit by things.
It is. But half of that litter comes from when China exploded a weather satellite.
That's a good point.
Prove that they could.
Dick, we are out of time, my friend. But again, you are welcome anytime you want. You just pick up the phone and talk with us, okay?
You mean that?
Yep.
Well, I'll be back in a couple of weeks.
Sure. Okay. Hey, you're gonna be with me through this election too.
I want to be.
We're gonna tap into you. Okay. Thank you, Dick. Dick Morris. We're going to put you on hold for a second. Tommy needs to talk with you. I'm coming back in a moment. 2 hours of open lines here on Coast to Coast AM.